You're all right. This morning we complete the series of talks on the principles of nature as they come to us in the human body. We have always recognized the human body as a miniature of the world. Paracelsus describes it as one of the three great books of creation. Anything that we seek for in the functions of the living bodies, we will find in the human form. If it is not in the body of the human being, then it is not part of the material nature to which we belong. But behind this is a great deal of philosophy which is not so well known. And in this divisions, there are points that I think are of basic interest, particularly this morning. We are dealing with the spirit now only in its essential nature as the human spirit. We're not going out into space. On the other hand, if we then can solve the mystery of the human spirit, we have solved the mystery of space. The difference is in magnitude, but not in principle. Therefore, we start in with the study of the spirit, and we begin to study it in terms of Bible literature, because we have a great many keys in the Holy Scriptures. Actually, we find, therefore, that in the beginning, there was space. And in space, there was an eternal power. This eternal power, we call God. We do not know what it is, really. We cannot experience it in its fullness. We cannot know exactly where it might have begun, if it ever did, or where it might end, if it ever does. But for all practical purposes, the Spirit is the eternal foundation of all change. All mutations take place within it, but Spirit itself is never divided. This was one of the Pythagorean theorems. And in space itself, it becomes more or less the negative polarity of God. In space, we have a symbol of a vast immensity within which creations of uncounted worlds come into existence. The astronomer beholds part of this mystery, but he has found no answer to explain it. We find many, many evidences of the presence of these universal principles, but we cannot solve their origin or animate their destiny. So we have to take certain things for granted. Now, in our own physical life, we have a combination of circumstances. We might liken this life to an electric light bulb. When the light is turned on, the bulb shines, and we have light. Someone turns off the bulb, there is no more light. After a while, the bulb itself will burn out. Maybe it will give 100 hours or 500 hours, but ultimately, the bulb will burn out. And someone is apt to say at that time that the light has died. It hasn't. It is the bulb that is worn out. And in the study of the human being, this is particularly important. The human being never really dies. It is only the bulb that is burned out. The body of the human being is so involved in the material substances of existence that the wear and tear of the spirit within attempting to manifest outwardly results in the course of time of the bulb burning out. The more advanced the individual becomes, the more he shelters and guards the light within himself, the longer the blaze will continue. But ultimately, it has been said in the ancient writings, all compounds must be dissolved. The great compound for man is spirit and body. This compound must ultimately be dissolved. But how is it to be ultimately ended or changed? It is to be ended or changed by transformation and transmutation. The individual as a being never dies. It is only the body which, becoming exhausted of potential, is no longer able to carry on. But with more discipline, more understanding, and more insight, the spirit has a longer duration. The growth of the person, the unfoldment of the nobility of the individual, the positive use of its creative and constructive skills, all these things help to lengthen the life of the bulb. They all help the individual to transmute or to create a new level of understanding. And each level as it rises is more subtle, more gentle, more permanent than those that have gone before. Therefore, evolution for man is a gradual unfolding of the body to permit the light to shine through. And the more highly evolved the person becomes, the more beautifully the light does shine through. So this morning we want to take a little study of some of these factors to see if we can make them a little clearer. In the Buddhistic doctrine, we find a study of the planes or levels upon which the human being functions. And we find these levels based largely upon Hinduism in the understanding or interpretation. According to not only the Eastern teachings, but many of the Western schools also, the proper abode of the spirit in man is in the apex of the left ventricle of the heart. The spirit rules from the heart, the mind rules from the brain, and the body rules from the solar plexus and the lower gangulated structures of the body. Therefore, we begin with Buddha's transmission of the idea of the Septapana cavern. The Septapana cavern was where the Buddhist initiates of ancient times received their private or deepest instruction. When they really wished to know the real law, they departed from the general group and retired into the cave of seven rooms where they could meditate in peace. The cave of seven rooms is, of course, the human heart. And it is here that the peace and silence and transmutation takes place. It was there, according to Buddha, that through the quiet contemplation of life, the individual came as near to the spiritual truths as it is possible to do in an embodied state. So out of the Septapana, the cave of the seven rooms, came the arhats and those who were to carry on the blessed doctrine until the advent of the Maitreya. And actually also, according to some of the psychic peoples, I think of Andrew Jackson Davis for one, the heart is connected with the head and with the crown of the head. And according to mystics and some psychics, when the time comes for a severance between the body and its indwelling spirit, the functions of the body in the magnetic field are all drawn together, and all the energies and principles of the organs, because each organ has its own living entity. All of these entities, all of the spirits of even the smallest drop of blood, converge toward the heart. And when they reach the convergence point, they become ready for transmission. They then ascend through the central Shashumna Nadi, or the great tube in the spinal cord, and come to the crown of the head. And the crown of the head, there is a spot which is the last to solidify in the baby. The small child almost always has a partial opening of the skull at the top. And when it reaches this point, then it enters into the samadhi of the Sushumna Nadi, the thousand petal lotus, and then departs from the body. This procedure is for all, but the problems involving it are well worth careful consideration. First of all, we are informed that the body is not just simply an accidental form that's been hung on us for our disappointments. It is part of our really important evolving knowledge, because it is through the body that we are capable of studying the actions of other people. Through the body we reach the world, we reach the family, we reach humanity. Through the body we become acquainted with the problems that arise in various degrees of evolution and development of human beings. We find out step by step most of the truths of the inferior world or the lower regions of body. Therefore, it is very important for the individual to recognize that the body becomes the vehicle of the spirit embodied within it. And the spirit embodied within it takes many years to perfect that body, at least bring it to the highest perfection possible. And in that time, it becomes a useful instrument. But today, most folks are not interested in thinking of the body as a vehicle or an instrument of growth. They think of it merely as an organ of extroversion. They think of it as a source of pleasant or unpleasant happenings. They do not realize that this body is a very important school, and that within this body, in the secret chambers of the heart, is the power behind us, behind the physical form, and that this power, together with the similar powers in others, constitutes one gigantic totality, which we call humanity in the world and God in heaven. This quality we then begin to analyze a little bit. We begin to realize that whenever we damage the body by neglect or by dissipation, we are injuring the manifestation of the power within the body. And we are also wearing out unnecessarily the electric light bulb, which is going to go out one of these days from lack of continuing usage. Therefore, it becomes very valuable to realize the importance of controlling and directing the daily life. Nearly all religions and philosophical systems of importance impose disciplines upon the physical existence of the person. These disciplines are often regarded as tremendously important simply as moral attributes of a spiritual growth. This is not the truth of the matter, however. The truth is that these experiences which disturb the growth of the inner life work a great hardship upon the total project of man's evolution. We find many cases today where we have a world of people only able to enjoy body as a reality. To them, spirits and minds and hearts and actually brains, for that matter, are very dim things. The only thing that is intimately real is the physical body and its contacts. And this is probably one of the greatest mistakes that we make, because the physical body is not the reality and never can be, because it is something which we are here to outgrow. Now, the inducements to outgrow the body are of several kinds. One of the inducements, the most common, is that we wear it out or dissipate it into a condition in which it is unable to function. Therefore, we are in a way neglecting it out of existence. Another way we use it is by overtaxing it and making greater efforts than the body is capable of supporting. And that way we also reduce its efficiency. Then we also devote it to false projects, among which, of course, are merely all of the material activities with which we are involved. Incidentally, the last few years particularly, there's been considerable emphasis upon this problem, that we are wasting energy, wasting time, and complicating existence by lack of discipline. Yet most people will not discipline themselves until they have to. And nature, in its wisdom, made health problems to help this disciplining, and then in society created wars and revolutions to indicate what man should not do. But there is no way of coaxing him into a state of virtue. He is not yet old enough and wise enough in his understanding to voluntarily correct his own faults without some inducement. And the inducement in almost all cases is freedom from pain, or freedom from want, or freedom from tension. Therefore, assuming the heart center in the body as being the seat of the spirit, we also find that it is from here that the spirit controls. The spirit does not control from the mind. The spirit controls from the heart. Heart has precedence over mind. Mind is an instrument. We may say that mind may be the chancellor, but the divine power is rested in the heart. And therefore, as the individual comes closer and closer to the heart doctrine, he comes closer to relaxing away from the pressures which disturb or destroy him. It is absolutely essential for the mystic or the individual seeking further spiritual growth to live with a strong heart focus. This means thoughtfulness of other people. It means charity. It means kindness. And it means a loving recognition of the beauties of life and the beauties of nature. And of course, in the heart, which is the abode of our spirit, we worship the spirit, which is the abode of us all. Therefore, the heart is very important. And the evolution of the individual is not that he becomes wiser and wiser, but rather that he becomes more and more virtuous, more and more in harmony with the great laws of existence. We are in trouble because we break these laws. And when we break these laws, we come in conflict with the law as it emerges from the Spirit or God within us. The Spirit within us is not contaminated by any outside factor. The only thing it can do under pressure is to suffer. And when the heart begins to suffer, we find a great many difficult emotions. And among some of them is the emotion of regret, and sometimes the emotion of hatred or things of this nature. But always the heart has to lead, because it is the seat of our immortality. And as it leads more and more, we find that the body reacts more and more constructively. The body has really no desire to take over. The only reason that it has assumed a dictatorship is because it is not supported by the conscious dedications of the mind and the emotions. The body does not want to rule the individual, but if nothing else is available, it will step in and do it. And when it does so, there's always trouble, because the body does not know what the spirit needs, but the spirit knows what the body needs. So we have now this problem of bringing back and working with a cycle of re-embodiments around the center of the heart of the individual. Now, as he comes into life, the heart becomes part of his essential makeup. The heart actually takes control of the body much earlier than we generally think. In fact, the probabilities are that it is there before the first physical cell appears. It is something much more important and more definite, and something that has a great deal of integrity and virtue in it. But by the time the child is born, the heart center is strongly established. And the establishment of it and the processes by which it is established are set forth in the Rig Veda in the avatars of Vishnu, the deity appearing in one body after another until it comes finally to the last body, the Kalki avatar, in which is the white horse. It carries the soul to heaven. But all of the symbols of the ancient religions tell the story of the creation of life within the body and its gradual emergence as an individual existence. It also reacts to the individual when he grows up. He grows up, perhaps, fortunately, in a good home or a kindly parental doctrines are followed. And then all of a sudden he comes to the dividing of the ways. He must become an individual. He must take on the responsibilities of self-discipline. This is the heart center reminding him that he must gradually come to value that above everything else on earth. He must know that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And his thinking in the heart is one of the disciplines that is hard to bring to a materialistic, a materially focused civilization. But today we are in the grave danger of misleading ourselves and others. And the time has come definitely to recognize the importance of coming to the throne of the indweller, that which is in within us as long as we live, the spirit of eternity, the unknown and unnamed God. There's a spark in every living thing. This spark is in the lowest creature. It is the tie by which all existing forms are bound to absolute immortality. As long as that spark is there, nothing can die. And when the spark can no longer abide because of the disintegrations of the body, then it retires and the body perishes. But then the dweller seeks a new flesh embodiment. And when the time comes, is reborn to continue the process. Now, what is this process that it is to continue? It is to continue to fulfill a certain test. It is part of a discipline. And in Northern Buddhism, it is part of an initiation. But the material life is a series of tests. It is a series of initiations into the mysteries of existence. All individuals are growing, some more rapidly than others. But no one can come into this world and live a reasonable length of time and go out without having learned something. Sometimes the person may deny that knowledge, but in the after-death experiences, it reproves itself. But there is no way of living without growing. But this growing can be stunted. It can be much less than would be natural or normal. It can fail to fulfill its essential purpose. For every step of growth means the correction of a weakness or a fault. And nearly everyone has faults of some kind. Very often we blame other people for them. But in the dweller in the heart knows what faults are our own. And those common faults that we have, of course, are hatred and jealousy and selfishness and combativeness and acquisitiveness. All of these faults are involved in two things: the relationship of the individual with the heart within himself, and the relationship of nations within the heart of the solar system, which is the sun. In other words, as in the little case, we get into trouble by failing to correct our mistakes. So in the larger case, we get into world catastrophe by failing to correct the great mistakes, which are nothing but the little mistakes grown in size. And we now have a family conflict, a world of words, unpleasant ones, over a back fence. And about the same time, and two or three nations get together and have a bad time. Everything is of the same type, differing in multitude or magnitude, but not in principle. And in principle, all things are leading toward the heart. The mistakes have all divided us from the heart center in ourselves, and our virtues bring us back again to it. And when we come back, however, we are better than we would have been had we not been tempted, because temptation moves salvation to a task by the individual himself. In other words, there would be no gain by experience if the individual could attain happiness and peace without experience. If he did not have to correct his own mistakes because some benevolent providence did the work for him, he would remain to the end selfish and ignorant. But he is not permitted to do this. He is reminded of the fact that his own presence in the world is a proof of his own need for growth, his own continuous challenge by which he must gradually unfold his own integrity. Thus, we have another important factor here: health. We have the help factor, in which individuals, through mistakes of one kind or another, create various ailments which sometimes cut them down in their prime. But altogether, all these things, whether it's digestive difficulty or an international problem, all arise from the same basic sources. The failure of the conscious person to understand the reason for himself and the way in which he must work with himself to fulfill his own purpose. Now, out in the larger sphere of things, we have concepts of God. And nearly every nation has some concept of the nature of deity. And this nature of deity has been, for the most part, built up from a contemplation of superiority in the material world. Those of highest rank are regarded as nearer to deity. Those of various particular outstanding abilities are said to be inspired. But in every case, the comparison has been that the divinity is a highly glorified humanity. It is a person who has been raised by adulation or public esteem to the estate of a deity. And in ancient times, nearly all deities were glorified human beings, remembered for their powers and principles long after their bodies were returned to the earth. So deity became, as one man called it, a highly glorified King Henry VIII or Louis XVI. God was the great nobleman, and all nations were serfs, and all individuals were serfs of this divine power. This has been gradually changed, particularly by Luther in the West, to the realization that the supreme overlord is not a Henry VIII, but that there's only one real ruler, and that is spirit itself. Everything else is a false ruler. But the false ruler must continue until the community or the world earns the right ruler. We must have the difficulties until we outgrow them. And there is no way of outgrowing them vicariously. There is no way in which, through a formula, we can grow. The growth must be real, and the growth must be tested by the power that is seated in the heart. When the heart power is satisfied, we are right. When the heart power supports us, we are right. But up to that moment or that time, we are in various degrees of rightness and lack of rightness, which we call the ordinary living conditions of humanity. So we find in the stories of the incarnations that we have a broad platform, assuming for general purposes that the human being, in order to fulfill the destiny for which he was created, will probably pass through approximately 1,000 embodiments. Now, this is probably an inexact figure, but it is in principle is obvious or indicative. During this period of time, the entity is learning step by step, and each of the embodiments is one day in the school of the growing spirit. Each day is a struggle, each problem must be faced, but out of it all comes a gradual enrichment. And this is well set forth in the Bhagavad Gita. The spirit was never born, and the spirit will never die. But it will be embodied in various forms, and the forms will live and die. But that which is true goes on, and the only thing that it takes with it is the enrichment of its own spiritual insight. Actually, as the Hindus believed, we are all, in a way, gods in the making. Because when we become wise enough to run our own affairs, we will be made masters over greater things. The purpose of all evolution is to produce those stars that shine in the sky, and beyond those, a great silence in which eternity abides forever in its own perfection. These things we have to learn by degrees. So the one thing we can do, however, is try to create an easy relationship between the spirit in the heart and the daily conduct of our lives. We can do all that we can to make the spirit happy. We can do what we can to fulfill its natural instinct to know, to grow, to think, to hope. We can also gradually get rid of the weak spots in the armament of our lives. We can learn how to adjust to circumstances, not for the circumstance's sake or for our personal sake, but because it is the way in which we worship the powers of life. Actually, virtue is the instrument of worship. The individual grows only by what he does. His words do not count very much. He is only able to guarantee that which he has performed by the definite effort of his own consciousness. Now, nearly everyone has some virtues to their credit, some more than another, other than others, but mostly we have quite a bit to our credit. And for the most part, we are respectable, kind-hearted, well-intentioned people. But somewhere in our compound nature, there still lurks a great deal of subtle difficulty. And it is because this difficulty is subtle, not quite so obvious, that we have a tendency to struggle desperately against it. In the way back times when battles were solved by throwing rocks at each other, problems could be solved rather simply. But now it's all much more complicated. The surface problems that annoyed our ancestors are very largely no longer dominant. But in their places, the submerged processes have come to the surface. They are much more powerful, much more difficult to handle, and much more rewarding when they are correctly handled. Right now, we have in the world a definite struggle for peace. Everyone is beginning to realize the tremendous penalty for hatred and discord. Everyone is looking for some way to find peace. And many suggestions have been made in this direction. But if you want to know, really, the answer, the problem will be to work out peace in your own life. And you will realize the difficulties that arise on this effort. That it's not as easy as it looks, because the pressures and tensions of living bring you into constant contact with people you cannot control and who will not see it your way, or who will not become honest simply because they are told to become honest. And the individual gradually weakens and joins them, or weakens in discouragement and departs in sorrow. This means that we have new and better lessons to and bigger lessons to learn. And now, in the next 25 or 50 years, we have got to solve most of the problems in society that we are now fighting with under our own skin. The war begins inside of us. Hate begins inside of us. All of the pollutions and all of the temptations and the massacres and all the miseries of life have their final origin inside of us. We no longer would permit some of them to break through. But when a great number of these people, all more or less inadequate, get together and combine, they form a terrible force. So we have to work with those problems. There is no way of outgrowing the problems of society except by outgrowing them. They cannot be legislated. They cannot be forced upon us by laws or by rules or by penalties. They must come through growth. Peace is when the individual has discovered that it is a greater truth than conflict. It is coming nearer and nearer to the core of life. Now, the spirit within us has its own functions. It has its own virtues. And peace is one of them. Peace is very important. Let's see a little bit about it. We will say to begin with that peace is a spiritual quality. It is something that belongs to the over realities of existence. The germ of peace is in us. The germ of peace is in that heart center where we hope to build the beginning of the golden wedding garment described by St. Paul. But we have now a peace center. What are we going to do with it? Well, there are lots of problems in peace. We would probably all like to have peace, but there are difficulties. One is we don't speak to our neighbor and they don't speak to us. That is a small thing, but it's not peace. Another time we have a big political conflict. Everybody wants something different. It ends in confusion. There's no peace and solutions are not found. We have many, many occasions in personal life where we resent people, where we hate people. I work with Neil with people, and I know many who have never spoken to a relative in 25 years because of a grievance or a grudge. And yet, with that grievance and with that grudge, they consider themselves to be highly spiritual people. But it doesn't look that way from the outside. Actually, the heart center is constantly impelling us to correct all aggressions and all indiscretions, to make life beautiful, to make living a gentle and kindly experience. But between that and the average person is the exalted concept of wealth, the fulfillment of ambition, the tyranny of money, and all the false values which take their places before virtue can be seated. So we do not accomplish this peace. And we talk about it, and we have all kinds of thoughts, but then another war breaks out. We are not learning. Now, from occult philosophy, perhaps, or at least from the esoteric doctrines, we get a realization of the values involved. But they are so difficult and so ultimate that the average person doesn't even try to meet their demands. They consider that it's much better to die in a half-conscious condition than to struggle with the pressures of self-improvement. But nature isn't going to let us get away with that. Little by little, that virtue is thrust upon us. Day by day, things become worse unless we make them better. Now, as we look around us in the world today and see all these problems, we say to ourselves, what are we going to do about it? What about ourselves? If the war breaks out, are we going to be one of the first casualties? If we have a very serious earthquake, are we going to be casualties? We don't know for sure many of these things. There's only one answer to all of it, that whatever may come, we can carry it with peace. That within ourselves, we have the strength to meet adversity without compromise. And without compromise, we are safe. And we are never going to be so hurt that we cannot recover. Whereas without this integrity, many have already committed suicide and many more will. All this works back to the God within. When we make peace with that, we have it. Until we make peace with that, there is nothing but uncertainty. The philosophers of old realized this, and they had various names to indicate these principles. They talked about the various orders of deities and the various orders of principalities of the invisible world. They also tell us many legends and fables about the world as it was before the deluge, in the ancient times when there was peace upon the earth. And we learn from our own scriptures of the beautiful Garden of Eden. Now, the Garden of Eden was a direct production of the principle of God founding the material existence. The Garden of Eden was the nearly perfect production of spirit. In its own natural form and natural state, it was at peace with all things. It was a paradisical sphere, and it was here that man studied the sacred writings, and his teachers were the angels. All of this is symbolical language, but it stands for a great meaning, for a great mystery. And that is the mystery of the material existence in its own purity. The material existence was not a world originally of pressures and of tyrannies. But into this world came Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve, one for one reason or another, were captured by the web of ulterior motive. They became involved in relationships which were not according to the doctrine that created Eden. So they were cast out of the garden and were set out into the world. And the world as we have it today is Eden polluted. It is Eden gone. It is Eden that is no longer in the valley of the Euphrates. It is the Eden that is no longer in the high Hemavats or in the mysterious temples along the Niles of Egypt. It is no longer here. There's only one way now to find this Eden again, and that is in ourselves. We must restore it in our own conduct, in our own inner life. Now, what do we mean by an inner life in this case? We don't mean just the job. We don't mean just the dinner and the meals, all the taking care of the children, all the eternal and inevitable television program. We don't mean that. We mean a life in which the individual achieves an individual adjustment with life, a life in which there are values gradually growing up. Now, if there are values growing up in the lives of parents, the children will grow better. If there are new values growing up in children, their relationships with elders will be better. In every case, we have 24-hour days. And part of that day, to quote even a character that was not so popular right now, Muhammad says that the 24-inch gauge is the measure of the individual. 3 times 8 hours makes the 24 hours of the day. These 24 hours are 8 hours for labor, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for growth. So the definite special attempt and understanding to improve oneself, to become more wise in good things, to become more patient in adversity, to become better informed on important details of life, living, and also having time for kindly relationships with our neighbors. In other words, we have to make a section, a selection, in which every day there is time for growth. Without some time set apart from growth, it's not going to make too much difference, maybe, in the long run, because we will keep on coming back, pestered with the same problems, until we grow up. We can do it maybe in 10 lives, or may take 100. But we will ultimately do what is right. And the struggle to do what is right is now for us, or for many people, a terrible, terrible task. The idea of turning off that television is more than the average person can stand. And furthermore, turning it on is more difficult than turning it off. And there seems to be no answer except to buy a larger instrument or to get in other stations. But we are going to be in the same way all the time. We are looking for one thing, for rest, for relaxation, for a sense of security, for sharing in life with others in the daily living problems of existence. We're not going to find it this way. We're not going to find it because we have more or less excluded the spirit from our entire pattern. We have set aside no time with which just to be human and give thanks for the privileges of existence in this world. We do not try to use the hours, not necessarily for heavy mental struggle, but for gracious acceptance, gracious adjustment, and a gradual, quiet maturing of our emotional and psychological structures. We are entitled to rest and repose, but we do not have any. we had more repose in the old days of the sweatshop than we have today. And that's quite a span. For basically everything that we do that is repose, that is quiet, that is peaceful, that represents a conscious effort to be better, is registered in the apex of the left ventricle of the heart. The spirit becomes aware, or is aware, for the reason that every one of these benevolent improvements releases part of the spiritual power that is locked within us. Now, this power is variously gradated and very carefully classified. Some parts of this power will be better,